It's time. Time for stimulating talk. Time for thought-provoking conversation. Time for the Lisa Wexler Show on WICC 600. Turn on your brain and get the real scoop on today's topics and events. Here is Lisa Wexler.
I'm so excited to be with you today. We have such a great show. 203-333-9422. Well, yesterday we spent a lot of time talking about impeachment. And guess what? That subject's not going away. We have more hearings tomorrow, and there'll be hearings next week. And I will definitely keep the phones open if you want to discuss that today. But we're also going to turn to other things in life. We have Amy Kurland coming on now. If you're a country music fan, as I am, you will have heard of the Bluebird Cafe in Nashville, because this is the place where many of the country megastars were discovered. And it's really cool. There's a documentary about it. The documentary has been shown to wide acclaim, and it'll be at the Ridgefield Playhouse on Sunday. We have lots of tickets to give away to it at 203-333-9422. If you want to call me, we'll queue up the tickets. We've got about five pair we can give away throughout the show, so we'll keep Christian busy today. And I'll have a trivia question for you to win those tickets coming right up. But we're going to chat with Amy Kurland, because country stars like Taylor Swift and Garth Brooks... And I already hear you thinking, is Taylor Swift even country anymore? Well, she certainly started out that way. We'll be chatting with Amy Kurland. In 1982, she founded this cafe. It's since become legendary. We'll chat with her about that and the origins of some of the great country music stars and what makes somebody stand out from the rest, right? What is that indefinable star quality? And I think Amy knows a little bit about it. So that'll be fun. Plus, we'll chat with an author of a book that I find to be so cool and fascinating. It's called Menus That Made History. Over 2,000 years of menus, from ancient Egyptian food for the afterlife to Elvis Presley's wedding breakfast. And let me tell you, everything in between. We're talking about menu for Henry VIII on flesh days, Robert Dudley's feast for Elizabeth I, the Shah of Iran's celebration of 2,500 years of the Persian Empire, Christmas Day in Alcatraz prison, and then there are some recipes that come along with it from different of these menus as well. Charles and Diana's wedding breakfast. What do you think Charles and Diana's wedding breakfast, July 29th, 1981, consisted of? Well, if I tell you that I don't know the translation, I hope you won't be angry with me. I don't know what Supreme de Valet Princesse de Galles is, or Fève au Beurre, something with butter, Mets à la crème and pomme nouvelle, new potatoes, and a salad, crème galilée. I don't know. What are quenelles? Don't know. Anyway. So that wasn't a good one. And then the first Academy Awards ceremonial dinner, which had filet of sole and half-broiled chicken, new string beans and long branch potatoes, Muhammad Ali's Top of the Tower breakfast. This is so much fun, this book. So much fun. And we're getting into holiday season, Thanksgiving, Christmas, Hanukkah. We're thinking about all the different ways in which we can gorge ourselves and feast. So we'll chat a little bit about the menus that made history and some of the items on these menus. Let me tell you, you would never believe that people would actually eat. All right, I want to begin with some important news before we go around, and we hope to have time today for You Be the Judge as well. It's a busy show. 203-333-9422. I think I want to let you know that the headlines today in the Hearst Media publications are important to know, because we've been talking and talking and talking about tolls. And it looks like Senator Martin Looney, who is a Democrat from New Haven, the state Senate majority leader, has essentially said, I'm not definitively saying no, but I'm pretty much telegraphing to you, Governor Lamont, that if we're going to do this $21-plus billion transportation renovation that you're talking about, we don't need to put into the mix the $300 million or so that you estimate will be the revenue from tolls. Because number one, when you think about it, it's a relatively small amount as a percentage of the kind of money we're talking about, this ambitious undertaking that Governor Lamont wants to transform and improve our transportation infrastructure here in Connecticut. If you really think about it, $300 million, first of all, it's an estimate. It's probably a high estimate. If it's anything like the plastic bag estimate, we know we're in trouble. The plastic bag estimate was that the Connecticut Department of Revenue Services would probably take in about $21 million. They've taken in about seven because they forgot about the law of unintended consequences. Many grocery stores, instead of charging people for plastic bags, simply stopped carrying them. So their revenue was grossly over. In other words, the revenue estimate was three times the amount that the budget is actually taking in. And that may very well be the same with tolls. People may end up doing the workarounds, the wayses, the avoids. So whatever the estimate is, I have a feeling it'll be dramatically lower. But that's just me. I could be wrong. But the bottom line is Senator Looney is, I think, correctly reading the public sentiment on tolls. And he's trying to get that off the table in order to concentrate on how we do erect the funding for this massive transportation undertaking. What will it look like to us in the short term, and how short is short term? If we're going to build out different lanes on 95 to relieve congestion and what are called the bottlenecks, well, what does that look like to us? When will those hours of construction be done? How long will it take? Over what seasons of time? Those are important questions for us because we're already in a daily trek that eats up our patience, eats up our gasoline, eats up our very valuable time, the commodity that we can never buy back. And I had suggested to Governor Lamont that the toll conversation would be a distraction from the more important conversations about what does it look like to improve transportation in Connecticut? How realistic or possible is it to dramatically reduce the commute back to Manhattan? You know, the commute to Manhattan is directly related to real estate values here in Fairfield County. You can't talk about one without the other. When I moved here in 1989, the commute on average between Westport, Connecticut, 57 miles from downtown Manhattan, it's actually 47 miles from downtown, but 57 miles from different parts of New York City. So let's say 50 miles was about 64 minutes on average most of the time. And it was about 40-something minutes to Stamford and then another 20 or so from Stamford and a slower commute making more local stops to Westport. And that was the average train rush hour. Non-rush hour was like 70, 72 minutes. Take a look at the latest Metro North, and I'm using Westport as an example because I'm most familiar with it, but you can take any stop and compare it to what it was 20, 30 years ago. It's 85 minutes now sometimes, and that's without the fact that very often it's delayed. That's the schedule time, 79 minutes, 82 minutes, 82 minutes. Sometimes it's faster to drive. Should it ever be faster to drive? We have to have a society in which we encourage mass transportation for all kinds of reasons. So I want to hear more about the nuts and bolts of Governor Lamont's transportation proposal. But I do personally think that the tolls, the heavy lifting required to make tolls palatable to Connecticut voters, personally, I don't think it can get done, and it may very well not be Governor Lamont's fault. He wasn't governor for the last 30 years. He didn't personally break all the promises that were broken by prior governors and prior legislatures, but nonetheless, those promises were broken, and the money that was taken from Connecticut taxpayers was not allocated the way it was supposed to be allocated, and the issue of trust is very real here in the Connecticut electorate. So Senator Martin Looney basically telegraphing to Governor Lamont, look, I'm really willing to consider a lot of this, but I think we need to get more money from the federal government. And the Republicans, Len Fasano has been public. He is the Senate Minority Leader. Themis Claridis is our House Minority Leader. The Republicans have said all along that they believe they can get it done without tolls. So today is Thursday. It's put up or shut up day. And we believe the Republicans are going to be releasing their plan to have a large majority of this transportation infrastructure happen without the imposition of tolls. So this is a conversation and a topic that we're paying very close attention to on the show. At 15 minutes after the hour, 203-333-9422, several headlines coming out of the Sono Mall in Norwalk. First of all, terrible, that fatal fall that happened at 2:30 a.m. earlier this week. The workman identified as Lorgio Jimenez Suarez, a 52-year-old sheet metal worker from Astoria, New York, was working about 1.5 stories up on the mall's exterior when he fatally fell to his death at 2:30 a.m. on Tuesday morning. Crews were putting, quote, the finishing touches on the new Sono Collection's exterior. He was part of a construction crew. He was braving moderate winds and light rain showers early Tuesday morning. You remember Tuesday night? It was not a great night to install a finished metal exterior to the mall. And Wayne Alley, who was the safety director and risk manager for the GC, said that the incident was a tragedy and that prior to this, the construction site had a, quote, impeccable safety record. And obviously, there will be a recreation of exactly what happened and exactly what went wrong. In other news about safety, this is on the interior. The Newark Hour headline is Balcony Railings Prompt Concerns. Alexander Sewell writing that a member of a Facebook chat group has warned other parents of a possible danger to children posed by glass railings that are fronting the new mall's atria. And they are essentially the centerpiece of the design. And apparently there was a recent fall in the Stamford Mall I hadn't heard about. An elderly person fell over. I think that was the report. It wasn't on a railing. I think it was an escalator. Anyway, safety is obviously a very big concern with the tragedy on the exterior. Nobody wants to take any risks on the interior. But the but Sono is maintaining, the Sono Collection contractor maintaining that the glass railings are safe, that the 42 inches is standard. A member of a Stamford Moms Facebook group on Wednesday alerted other parents. This is what she said happened to her. She said she was there, and the workers warned her to keep her own toddler from playing near the glass railing. The workers cited, quote, unspecified design concerns with the railing. So this mother wrote, caution alert, keep your kids off the glass rail at the Sono Mall. My two-year-old was playing at a joint in the glass rail. He wasn't being rough, but rather exploring. Two construction men urged me to keep him away. They said they were concerned about the stability of the design. Yikes. Well, you know what's wrong with this, right? Whatever mom is writing that, you know you always need to have the hand of your toddler wherever you are. What do you mean he was playing, but he wasn't rough? Would you let any toddler in your area go near something that could have a steep incline on the other end? I don't know about you, but I don't want my two-year-old exploring joints of anything three stories up. Let me keep him away to someplace safer. 203-333-9422. Lots of other news coming up on the Lisa Wexler Show. Stay tuned. Can we get personal for a little bit? Last night, I had the most agonizing foot cramps in my life. I'm plagued by them once in a while, and I know that they're correlated to eating certain foods. For example, I can't eat bananas. Don't tell me the bananas with the potassium. With me, the bananas go straight to sugar, and I can't eat them. I haven't been able to eat bananas in a long time. But, you know, yesterday I had not one but two Hershey bars. Who are we kidding? But I had it around noon, and usually I can still go to sleep. But last night, I had the most outrageously painful, agonizing toe cramps. And I'm pretty sure that I am going to get diabetes if I don't watch my sugar. It does not run in my family. As soon as I say to my parents, I think I might get diabetes, immediately I get, there is no diabetes in our family. You can't get diabetes. I'm like, no, Ma, I think I can. Because I have this thing called polycystic ovary disorder syndrome thing. And along with that is a propensity towards what they call insulin resistance, which means my insulin is resisting. It's resisting my metabolism. It doesn't want to lose weight. I say to it, can you please lose some weight? No, I will not. I resist. So what I'm trying to do, you know, we have these wonderful ads for The Doctor Is In on the Lisa Wexler Show. I'm trying to get a doctor in to talk about diabetes ASAP. I've put out my feelers. Hopefully we'll get somebody on soon because I need to know. I saw a recent piece, you know me, I'm doing my deep dive on research, and it says that I should eat chia seeds, except I have no idea what they are. What are chia seeds? The only chia I know is the chia pet. Remember the chia pet, that thing that looks like a spiny porcupine combination Japanese little bonsai? I don't know what chia seeds are. But apparently chia seeds and also turmeric. And the thing about turmeric is I went to buy a bottle of turmeric not too long ago at Whole Foods. And they wanted $35 for it. $35 for a bottle of vitamins. I thought I would have, I had a stun fit. And the woman said, do you want it? And I said, no, I don't want it. Here, take it back, $35 for a bottle of vitamins. Am I crazy? But apparently turmeric is some kind of magic thing. Anyway, I made a vow to God last night in the middle of what my agonizing foot cramp. I will not have sugar anymore. No more chocolate for me. Please stop punishing me. So today I got up and I made myself a scrambled egg. Because guess what? Eggs are good for people when they have diabetes. There's a list of 16 foods. And then one of them is a noodle at the end that I never heard of. Some kind of Japanese noodle, which is high in fiber and good things. And actually low in carbohydrate, even though it is a noodle. But it's packed, they say, in a very fishy thing. And so I'll have to wash the fishiness off of it. And then go ahead and... And then I'll be able to go ahead and eat the thing. So 203-333-9422 is our number, 203-333-9422. We're going to be speaking in just a few minutes with Amy Kurland, who is a pretty amazingly bright gal, and we'll be talking about the Bluebird Cafe documentary that's coming to the Ridgefield Playhouse on Sunday. 203-333-9422. But I just thought I would share my pre-diabetic agony, in case you want to call and tell me something about it, in case you want to share. Jay from Fairfield, hello and welcome to the show today. Would you like to talk about tolls or toe cramps? What's on your mind?
Let's talk about both, but let's talk about your toes. I am not a doctor, but I can tell you that I suffer from something called neuropathy.
Do you know what that is? I do. My husband has terrible neuropathy.
Yeah, it's more prevalent in men than it is in women. But women do get it in parts of their body. And the way you're describing it, it sounds like, I'm not a doctor, but it sounds like what you're describing. But don't keep talking about diabetes. You don't want to wish it on.
I don't want to wish it on, but it's a very real, unfortunately, side effect of this other syndrome I have, which you don't have because you don't have ovaries.
No, I don't, but I have a slight diabetes, too. I'm just over the border. Like, my sugar's like 100.
Okay.
Which is, they say anything over 100 is...
Not great.
99 is not good.
But, right.
You know, and I take my my blood maybe once a day, twice a day.
You do?
But, yeah.
How do you do that?
I just stick myself.
Really?
With a glucose meter. Yeah, sure.
You know, there's a new way to do this, Jay. You know that I went to the Galien Awards a couple of weeks ago, and the Galien Awards are set by Nobel Prize winners in chemistry and physics and everything and medicine, and they are among the biotech world. What they feel are the best inventions every year in the world of biotechnology, and
yes.
The number one. One that they only do three awards a year. They're in different categories, only three. And the one that won the Best Medical Technology Award was the award that is a sensor that substitutes for pricking yourself for blood. Did you know about this?
Yes. Yes, I saw that on TV. I think that might be for people that are more have a serious case of diabetes. I have, like, not a serious case at all. But I think it's for people that need to check themselves 5-6 times a day.
But even once a day, why would you want to prick yourself if you don't have to, Jay?
It just takes a second, and it doesn't even hurt, and it takes like under 14 seconds.
Really?
Yeah, I'll demonstrate it for you one day. It's really, really very, it's nothing.
Wow.
I could have done it 10 times talking to you on the phone right now. It's unbelievable.
What part of your body are you pricking?
My fourth finger, my ring finger.
Oh.
Just because, just the underside of my ring finger, and you need very, very little. You need a minute little speck of blood, and then you put it on, it goes on the strip, and then you know your number, and that's it.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, and you say you have no diabetes in your family, so it's probably has something to what you're talking about. But another thing I wanted to touch on before you let me go,
sure,
is don't deprive yourself a candy bar, because if you do that, yeah, you're going to go ahead and eat two ham and cheese sandwiches. You know what I mean? If you deprive yourself of what you want to eat, you're going to substitute it with something horrible, like two pieces of cheesecake or something.
Yeah,
you know?
No, that's probably true. But I think initially I need to stop, because when I get that craving, I can't stop. So I didn't have two, you know, I didn't have a half of a Hershey bar. I had two whole Hershey bars. Now, that's not normal.
Yeah, you know, I was going to say, up with two Hershey bars at 12 noon?
I came home from the show, and I was hungry. I hadn't eaten a proper breakfast. And I had lunch, and I knew that there were the Hershey bars in my refrigerator, so I ate them.
Oh, God. Well, that gave you the energy. Yeah,
they called
the energy
to me
that you needed.
Yeah, and I like the taste.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Sure. And that'll last until dinner time.
Exactly. That's exactly what happened. And I didn't eat much for dinner, and I had a little bit of an apple and some chicken for dinner, but then I got these terrible toe cramps. Terrible.
Wow. Oh, God. Yeah. Terrible. You could try topical stuff like Tiger Balm. I know that works for me.
Oh, that's good to know. I didn't know there was anything topical that would work.
Oh, my God. It's wonderful.
Tiger
right
Balm?
Over the counter.
Okay.
Yeah, Tiger Balm.
Thank you.
Yeah, I get it in the dollar store, actually.
But thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, just put it on like it's a lotion on your toes, and you'll feel it.
That's wonderful.
I like that feeling, so I don't know if you'll like it or not. And it doesn't stain or anything like that, but you will feel better.
Okay. Thank you, Jay. Thank you for the tip, and thanks
just
for calling.
Me Dr. Schwartz. That's okay.
All right. Thanks, Jay. Well, I am a doctor, but I'm a doctor without a diploma. I'm a DWD. You know, there are MDs, and then there are DWDs. I'm a Jewish mother. Are all Jewish mothers doctors? Perhaps. We're going to be right back, and we're going to chat with Alex Johnson, who wrote this phenomenal book that I think, personally, would make such a cool gift for people around holiday season. It's called Menus That Made History. It's a hardcover, beautiful book with really cool graphics and design and menus and color. And we're going to chat with Alex when we come back. 203-333-9422. And you can call and become part of the conversation on the Lisa Wexler Show. With Thanksgiving around the corner, once again, we're thinking about food. And, you know, when the cold sets in and the winter sets in, I think also in many ways we think about food and staying warm and being comfortable and holidays and being around a fire. This book came upon me. It's called Menus That Made History, Over 2,000 Years of Menus, From Ancient Egyptian Food for the Afterlife to Elvis Presley's Wedding Breakfast. And it was so intriguing. First of all, it's a beautiful book. But it's everything from the first class dinner on the Titanic, April 14th, 1912, to the ones that were served to the peons in third class and the second class, to the Hindenburg's millionaire flight, to the first menu on the moon, Delmonico's, quote, first ladies' luncheon of 1868, the history that goes along with these menus is fascinating. And joining us now are the gentlemen that put together this extraordinary book, Alex Johnson and Vincent Franklin. Welcome to the Lisa Wexler Show.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Hello, hello, hello. So we've got Alex and Vincent on the phone at the same time. Menus That Made History. Let me start with you, Alex. Alex, how did you get these menus? How did you find them?
Well, it's just a lot of research, really. I mean, there are some that are floating around that you can think of immediately, but there are others that you come across, like the ladies' luncheon that you mentioned, which are, you know, very important menus, and they really illuminate a part of history. I mean, that one in particular. I mean, up to that point, women restaurants didn't allow women to dine without males at their table, so we thought it was important to include something like that in the book.
Yeah, you say that the food on this 1899 menu, heavy on turtle, is almost entirely irrelevant. By the way, and when they say turtle, was it really a turtle?
Up to this point, there are a lot of turtles being eaten, even though it's obviously frowned upon a lot later. I think that was it was interesting looking through the menus, how much turtle is eaten, wasn't it, Vince? I mean, I know some of the ones we looked at were plenty.
Turtles have a real problem in that they are absolutely delicious. British sailors found the turtles on their travels, and it was a long time till they even got any back to England because they were so delicious that sailors ate them on the return. And it became such an important part of the food and such a thing that was celebrated at tables. If you were posh, you had turtle. That middle-class diners who couldn't afford turtle invented something called mock turtle soup,
right,
which many of us now think is just made up but because it's in Alice in Wonderland. But mock turtle was a soup that was made up so the poor, like me and Alex, could afford to eat the same delicious soup as the rich were eating.
Also, it's a great line in a standard song that's been sung forever and ever, you know, by Cole Porter, the mock turtle.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I didn't know that it came from a real. I thought it was exactly that. I thought that was a fiction. So people, were they eating like off the shell, could I ask? Like, how did you eat turtle?
Well, sailors brought them back because it was just initially just because they could, by having turtles on board, have fresh meat, which was pretty rare in the 18th century because there was no refrigeration on ships. So all the food you ate had to be salted to be stored. So it was just on the way back they could have this.
I see.
But then we almost made them extinct. We imported thousands over those first decades of having them. So that, yeah, people did eat it just as turtle, as meat. But a way of making it go further, of course, as we all know, if we've had to make our daily budget or weekly grocery budget last, is soup is a great way of making your dollar go further. So they turn the turtle into soup.
I see. And, you know, it was astonishing to me as I was leafing through some of these menus. What I love about the book, it's called Menus That Made History, is that every menu is accompanied by some context, some history, the reason why you chose it for the book. And you learn a lot as you're looking through this book. And it's random in its own way. In other words, you go back and forth between different cultures, back and forth between different times, and it makes it just a wonderful book that you want to pick up again and again. I saw on one of the menus that somebody was eating walrus. Walrus.
Yes, I think that some of the menus really have some astonishing ingredients. I mean, one of my favorite ones is on Christmas Day in 1817, the Siege of Paris, and the German army is besieging Paris, the city. And people are getting starving, and they're eating everything, and they're making things like rat salami, and they're eating begonias. And then one of the restaurants, Voisin, they start actually cooking up animals from the Paris Zoo. So you have a menu there with things like stuffed donkey head and elephant soup and wolf haunch, which shows you how desperate the city was getting, but also, you know, how the richer upper-class people were still kind of eating quite well, really. There's some fascinating things in there.
Well, it's fascinating, and altogether, I mean, to the extent that menus represent civilization,
We started this people always say, don't they, that you are what you eat.
Yes.
And if we are what we eat, then lists of the food that we eat should tell us an awful lot about us and about the way we live. So we chose these recipes. While some of them have, you know, extraordinary things like walrus and narwhal and whatever in them, lots of them are kind of are menus that celebrate great times from our history, and they tell us what people were doing at the time. So we managed to unearth from research the first Thanksgiving menu, for instance, what was served by those pilgrims at the very first Thanksgiving, which is perhaps a little bit different to what we associate today. And then sort of even things like, you know, very ordinary food like hot dogs, but actually that Roosevelt served that up to King George VI when he went over to visit just before the Second World War. And it was a brilliant way, by serving hot dogs, of bringing those cultures together, of celebrating the extraordinary development of America and American culture and bringing them together through that menu. You know, we associate state visits like that with people sitting down in kind of, you know, rows with silver cutlery and eating food that the rest of us don't have. But it was brilliant that the two nations that were going to fight that Second World War together were brought together by this very ordinary barbecue menu, you know, of hot dogs and cranberry jelly and salad and rolls that the King of England and the President of the United States shared just before that extraordinary bringing together of those two powers to fight the Second World War.
It was wonderful. I also loved when you talked a little bit about the context of climbing Mount Everest. Was it Mount Everest or one of
That's
the mounts?
Right.
And how the different teams chose different menus, and the one that you argue was the better one in terms of lasting and nutrition, that team made it, and they made it faster than the ones that didn't make it, right?
Yeah, that's the trip to the South Pole, actually. That's not the Everest, but you're quite right. Very cold, difficult places to be, the South Pole. And the English team took the wrong food. They took high-protein food, which is what you would take to train before you go to the South Pole. But actually, when you're covering the kind of miles and burning up the kind of calories they were in those extreme conditions, what they needed was fats and sugars, which your body can more easily digest. And Amberson, who was the Nordic explorer who got there first, he got that right. And the English team, the British team, got it wrong. And there's an argument that one of the main reasons that they failed to be the first team, and in fact, sadly, on the way back, of course, the team famously perished on the way back, was that not only had they chosen horses instead of dogs, but they'd taken the wrong food, and that the men were almost literally starving as they approached the pole.
Yeah, and you talked
and
about...
And heartbreaking, because of course they got there, but when they got there, they found somebody else's flag.
Yes. And you talk about...
Interesting.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry,
yeah.
I was going to say the Everest one is interesting as well, because they basically survived on a huge amount of hot tea, sardines and mint cake. And you think, you know, the amazing physical exertions that requires. And they needed so much hot tea because they were basically getting dehydrated all the time. So they're perpetually sourcing their tea from the snow and ice and making it as they go along.
And I also loved, you know, speaking of exploration, we're chatting with the authors of Menus That Made History, this marvelous book. It's a great present for people, and it's just a great thing to have for people that just want to read it and enjoy it. But I loved the first menu on the moon, July 20th, 1969. You know, I'm thinking about Tang. I'm not even thinking about that the astronauts are actually able to eat. And the menu is 4 bacon squares, peaches, 3 sugar cookies, pineapple grapefruit drink, and coffee. But you talk about how Buzz Aldrin did what he wanted. Tell us the story. It's great.
Yes, well, he also celebrated really the first communion as well. So he'd already kind of got that sorted out beforehand, because he was a pastor, and he was very keen on making man's first visit to the moon, giving it a proper religious angle as well. So, yes, he kind of slightly surreptitiously celebrated the first communion, which is interesting. I think another thing about that is that the bacon through space, if you look at space menus generally, bacon has always been very popular. I'm not entirely sure why, but it's one of those constants that people seem to love.
I can shed a little light on that, Alex, having looked at why it was that up Everest they took sardines and Kendall mint cake, which, if you've ever tasted it, they're both really strong flavours, is that in the airless atmosphere, in a dry airless atmosphere, you can get congested. In space, they get very congested, you know, like having a cold, because there's no gravity to help you drain, if that makes sense. And we all know what it's like when we've got a head cold. We often don't want to eat, and we can't taste things as well as we can when we've got a nice clear passages. So in space, very strong flavors, or fairly strong flavors, like bacon, which is of course salty and very a very strong flavor, are very popular, just as they are up Everest, where you eat Kendall mint cake, even though I promise you, as a man from the north of England, where Kendall mint cake comes from, it's one of the most vile things to eat at zero, you know, at sea level. But I'm told at the top of Mount Everest, it's absolutely delicious.
And then you say the first vegetarian restaurant was in Zurich in 1898. That's really cool. So cool.
Yes. I mean, obviously, people have been eating vegetarian food for a long time. But that's according to the Guinness Book of Records, which is kind of some way of confirming it. That was the first one, Hiltl. And it's still going strong today. They were very keen. I mean, it was regarded as a bit cranky at the time, obviously. But they persevered, and they travelled all over the world, especially to India, to bring back recipes and ideas and menus so that they could keep it going. But yes, that's the first one there.
That's the first one maybe in Europe, obviously not in India.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, this is the thing with a lot of these menus. You're talking about the first ones that we know about. I mean, we look at some of the kind of earliest possible menus going back thousands of years that we've kind of had to recreate because there's obviously no actual written paper. I mean, I know, Vince, you did a couple of those, didn't you?
I did. If you want to find out, I was absolutely of the belief that, you know, cavemen ate mammoths because I'd seen it on the Flintstones. They had a big,
sure,
you know, stone, and actually for a long time they weren't that far from the truth. That is what they ate. But these guys were much more sophisticated than we thought. They've recently unearthed a body and found from things like the plaque on its teeth and what's left in its stomach from, you know, the scientists, as they look through in a way that we never used to be able to, even 20 years ago. The technology now that's available means we can examine these things in much more detail and discover that they were also doing things like treating themselves for illnesses, if they, you know, using mosses to treat conditions that they had and pain relief and things. So that actually why we think of these people as really kind of crude and sort of, you know, surviving literally by hitting things on the head and sticking them in a fire, they were actually much more sophisticated than we think. And they put together really clever menus, including menus for travelling up and over the Alps. Ozzy the Iceman, who was found in the Alps, we found through the contents of his stomach what his last meal was and how he'd smoked the deer to make it easier for travelling. As we know, if you're in travelling across America, if you're trying to drive cattle across America, you took, you know, dried meat as a way, you know, that you could chew on all day long. Well, that's exactly what these people thousands of years were doing when they were crossing the Alps in Europe. They were drying reindeer meat or deer, and they were chewing it as they went. Do you know, we've not come on nearly as far as we think in terms of the kind of food we choose to eat. We've got a lot to learn from these menus from the past.
Well, and I also think, going back to the theme of civilization, to the extent that people fool themselves into thinking that we're civilized and that a menu is an indicia of that, the truth is that this shows how uncivilized we are. I mean, if you are what you eat and you eat everything, as far as I'm concerned, you're not civilized at all.
I think there's some truth in that. And some of the menus we've found that have been, we were always looking for menus that not only had interesting food, but had great stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what we were interested in. And there's a menu from 1971 from the Shah of Iran, who at the time was, you know, an absolute monarch in that country. And he had a celebration into which he invited the heads of state from all around the world, which cost over $200,000 per person.
Wow.
Which just kind of shows you how disconnected he was from the people that he was, you know, he was supposed to be looking after, supposed to be leading, because at the time they were in recession and there was massive unemployment, and he had this extraordinary indulgent banquet with food we could never dream of. So it was important to us that we told stories that were from the very simplest of food that was enjoyed, like fish and chips, which I know if anybody comes over to Britain from the United States and you don't have fish and chips, you've not visited our culture. It is the heart of British food. It's our takeaway. We've got the menus from that and what that says about the Industrial Revolution over here, right through to kind of coronation banquets of our kings, the food that the presidents were serving to our kings. And also, I really love the menu I found from the Blue Pheasant Tea Rooms, which I don't know if you're aware of this tea room. It's a tea room near Miami that was started in the 19th century by local women when that was a kind of still a rural area, who wanted to do good work. And they're partly responsible for saving the Everglades. And they partly funded that work by running a really small tea room. And we've got the menu from that tea room that they ran as they built schoolhouses and churches and tea rooms and raised money. It's an absolute, you know, it's a menu that captures a very late sort of pioneer spirit in a way. These were women who didn't just sit at home and knit, but came together to change the world around them. But you can see how they did it through something really simple, like running a tea room. And then bizarrely, we associate America over here from Europe, when we look at you guys with coffee, you know, we even refer to our black coffees over here as an Americano, but actually they were running a tea room, serving tea, that great symbol of British oppression of America from the 18th century. It's an extraordinary menu, and we were able, from finding these menus, to find stories about people that I think if you read the book, you might never have thought of those people, but it's sometimes very ordinary people in society that make massive changes. You know, these women in Miami saving the Everglades, a man going to the moon who we associate for his sort of his work as an astronaut, but actually the thing he took with him was his belief in God.
Right.
And actually, we've used these menus to try and get into the people that made the food, that ate the food, and the world that they lived in. So while there are menus in there, and indeed a few recipes if you want to recreate some of the menus yourself, really it's a book of stories about how people have sat round tables together and broken bread together for thousands of years, and what we can learn about the type of bread they break.
So I have to say, the one that really got me, because I'm a New Yorker, was, and it's so recent, was Pope Francis's New York dinner just a few years ago, September 2015. So this, and the menu is caprese, and it's raviolini, and it's veal medallions, bustiolola, and it's different Italian wines. And I'm thinking to myself, he lives in Italy. He lives in Rome.
Why
not serve him a pastrami sandwich on rye? He's coming to New York. Why are they giving them New York Italian when he lives in Italy and he can get all the Italian he wants there? I thought it was hysterical. Really?
Yeah, there's no doubt. You should definitely write the next book of this, because this is exactly the kind of stories we were looking for. You know, when we visit a foreign country, isn't part of wanting to go there to explore the culture of that country and eat their food?
Of course.
But of course, and this is a Pope, to be fair to him, who when he lives at home, he's a very, very simple man, and he cooks his own food. He eats very simple, simply. But when he goes to New York, he is sort of grabbed and whirled into this, whirled up into this amazing kind of trips that he has to do. And it's the same chef who actually she cooked for the previous Pope too. And everything apart from the lobsters, I think there was lobster which they brought in from Maine, but nearly everything else that was served was kind of Italian. He must feel like he's going around, you know, the equivalent of going to a Holiday Inn, that wherever he goes in the world, he's always in a Holiday Inn. But for him, that Holiday Inn just happens to be the Vatican.
Exactly. I thought it was really something, and a little bit tone deaf, because he could have been served anything in the panoply of American food, but this was such an exclusively Italian wines, Prosecco. I mean, everything was Italian in the menu. I just thought it was funny. If he wants Italian, believe me, he can get good Italian in Rome. He doesn't have to come to New York to get good Italian food. So I really enjoyed it. Well, gentlemen, the book is marvelous. Menus That Made History. Vincent Franklin and Alex Johnson, thank you for calling into the show today. I wish you great success with this. I really loved it, and I read a ton, and I get a ton, and I'm just so happy that I have this little book, Menus That Made History, and I encourage our audience and our listeners to get it on Amazon or look it up in Barnes & Noble or wherever they get books, because I think you'll love it, and I think it tells a lot of wonderful stories. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming on the show today.
Thanks for inviting
us. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. 7 minutes before the hour on the Lisa Wexler Show. We'll be right back. And welcome back to the show. Hola, bola. It's a few minutes before 11 o'clock. And in the next hour, we're going to speak to the founder of the Bluebird Cafe in Nashville, which is going to be really fun. And we've got tickets to give away. Oh, you know what we have? We've got tickets to give away to Luann de Lesseps, Countess. Are you a Real Housewives of New York City fan? If you are, then you know my sister Jill Zarin. She's an original Roni. I'm going to give you a chance to win tickets. Luann, I can't call her Countess. To me, she's Luann. She's coming on the show soon to talk about her appearance, but we have a pair of tickets to give away. She's going to be at the Richfield Playhouse on December 6th, and she's a singer, and she's got a great audience and a great act, and people love watching her sing. So let me ask you this. Can you tell me at 203-333-9422, give me the name of one of the original housewives of New York City, other than the Countess and other than Jill Zarin? You know any others? If you can call with that, then I know that you're somebody who won't want to miss this evening of entertainment with Luann. So tell me the name of one of the original Real Housewives of New York City at 203-333-9422. In order to win a pair of tickets to go see Countess Luann de Lesseps at the Richfield Playhouse in December. 203-333-9422. Do we have any Bravo junkies here? Incidentally, Bravo. Oh, here they come. Here come the lines. Incidentally, the very first BravoCon is going to be happening in Manhattan over the weekend, and my sister is going to be there on Saturday and Sunday. She invited me to join her on Saturday, but but I'm not sure I can make it in, and we're going to talk about it. But anyway, all right, let's go to Ann from Milford. We'll take your calls in order, and we'll see who can win the tickets first. Ann, hello, and welcome to the show today. Can you tell me a name of one of the original Housewives of New York City?
Was it Bethany Frankel?
Yeah. Congratulations to you, Ann. Would you like to go to the show?
You know what? I don't think we'll go in the winter. I don't think we'll go that far.
Okay, Ann. Then we'll take the other calls.
Else. All but right. I want to say this one thing to you.
Yes.
I keep seeing our governor walking around with a water bottle in his hand, a plastic water bottle.
Why?
I don't know. Well, he came out of some meeting yesterday and he had a water bottle in his hand. And another time, maybe 2 months ago, he came out of another meeting. Well,
maybe
that
he's
water
thirsty.
Bottle.
Maybe he's a good water drinker. That's a good thing. That's a good habit.
Plastic,
thanks, Ann.
It's plastic.
I know.
Bye.
You're right. Good point.
Bye.
Thanks for calling. We're going to go to Marge. Hi, Marge from Stratford. Hello.
Hi. How are you?
Hi. Good. Can you tell me a name of a real housewife of New York City?
I hope so. Sonia Morgan?
You know what? I'll take it. She wasn't the very first season, but she was like the second. So we'll take it. Yes. Congratulations.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you. So, I love your show, by the way.
Oh, thanks, honey. So are you going to go to the show?
Yes.
Oh,
are you kidding
good.
Me? Of course I would.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
All right, Marge. So stay on the line. We want your name and your email and your telephone number, and the tickets will be available for you and a guest at Will Call. Okay. Wonderful. Stay online. Christian will take your information. It's 11 o'clock. We'll be right back with the next hour live of the Lisa Wexler Show, so stay tuned.